Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
For the last time, I'm not your mother. I was only 19, and I'm still a firefly.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Amy Garland and Jeff Coleman? Do y'all like Amy and Jeff? Amy Garland and Jeff Coleman are fixtures in the Arkansas music scene. Both prolific songwriters with their own albums, they are here tonight together performing for you. All right, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my right here strumming is 1931 National Resonator is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark has played with the late David Honeyboy Edwards. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and so tonight our featured artist is Arkansas painter Julia Pistol, and our featured piece is this painting here entitled Bill and Socks, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Julia at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our writers take us back in time to childhood and the games children play. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Bill Scott plays alone with his own imagination and will end the night with Newton Jones as he finds an unlikely ally to play a game of catch. But let's start the night with Brooke Berger as she takes charge in a game on the high seas in The Demise of a Sea Captain.
Prepare for battle! It had been a calm day at sea when we started out that afternoon. It was an aimless mission with a small crew. My younger brother, age 7, my two cousins, 9 and 8 respectively, and myself, age 11, and clearly the only one mature enough to serve as captain over this ragtag bunch of scallywags. Not to mention it was my idea. We climbed aboard our ship, the old chain link fence, the hull, the canopy of the adjacent tree, the mast, the shaded area, the deck. I instructed the elder of the cousins to climb up into the crow's nest, the top of the fence just under the arboreal mast, to take a gander at what may lay ahead in our course. As one hand gripped the trunk of the mast, he leaned out over the hull, held his hand over his eyes, and scanned the vast sea of pine straw that lay before us. "All's clear, Cap," he said as he hopped down. "Wait," my brother shouted. "I think I see something." "Yeah," the younger cousin chimed. "It looks like a tentacle." "Hang on and let me get a better look," I said, trying to keep my cool for the sake of my crew. If we were about to go to war with some sea monster, I needed their heads screwed on straight. I focused in my finger binoculars and scanned the horizon for dangers lurking in the shadows. When suddenly, "I see it! Man your stations!" They scrambled for their guns as I leapt from the crow's nest. As I finally laid hands on my branch rifle, it took me a few seconds to locate the best gun in the ship's arsenal. The two tentacled monstrosities sprung up out of the straw waters and let out a hostile screech. Yarg! It was an uncanny beast, a pallid face and a long, gangly body, its tentacles whipping and whirling through the air and around its head in malice. The five appendages protruding off the end of each of its tentacles scratched at the sea and slung straw water all around it in a cloud. It bared its teeth in a menacing grin and threatened to overtake us as it moved toward the ship with lightning speed. "Fire!" I commanded. Like a well-oiled machine, the crew fired in unison. Pow, pow, bang, bang. The swift water creature seemed to dodge the bullets of three guns with ease. "We're missing him," the elder cousin shouted. "Just keep firing," I yelled, unsure what to do next. Pow, pow. Bang, bang. Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. My brother, apparently, had wisely thought to stash a machine gun in his barracks. Though it was strictly against protocol to possess a weapon with more firepower than the captain's, at that moment, I was glad for his disobedience, though a little miffed at myself for not thinking to grab my bazooka. Yargh! The aquatic beast screamed again, but withdrew, and I was sure it was at least wounded. "I think we got him," I shouted. It did not back down for long, though, and soon its tentacles waved frantically as it rushed the ship again. An overeager youngster, junior cousin, stood up on the edge of the hull to get a better shot. As he fired away, I could see his foot slipping on the thin railing. Somehow, he knew he was falling before he fell. "I'm falling," he screamed. The elder cousin reached for his brother, but it was too late. He splashed into the straw waters in a cloud of dust. "Man overboard!" Enticed by the younger cousin's flailing arms, the beast rushed towards him. "Y'all get me out of here!" My brother and the elder cousin reached for his arms to lift him back onto the ship as I continued firing. As junior cousin climbed safely back aboard, dripping from head to toe with pine straw, I decided my firepower was too weak to battle this sea demon. I needed something stronger. And that's when I remembered some grenades I had left in the captain's cabin after all. "Y'all keep shooting," I commanded, once everyone was back at their position on the gun port. Shots rang out in rapid succession as I dashed from my station. Pow, pow, bang, bang, na-na-na-na-na-na-na. From a distance, I heard the sea behemoth scream out in rage. Yarrgh! Sweet gum grenades in hand, I headed back to the deck. But I could no longer hear the guns of my men. "Oh no, they've been overtaken," I thought. "I should have never left my post." I approached the hull remorseful, but still ready for battle. Then I saw the aftermath of what had unfolded in my brief absence. The sea monster had breached the hull, and my men, they seemed to be pleading with it. "Hey," my brother said, running up to me. "William said he wants to be the captain now. He's tired of being the monster." And that's how I met my demise as a sea captain. Unwilling to accept a demotion to deckhand, I relinquished my captain's cap to my former nemesis. It's wise to quit while you're on top, so I had heard in my time at sea. I handed over my weapons and headed inside for a glass of red Kool-Aid to help swallow my defeat as someone else's war raged on under the hot afternoon sun.
Born and raised in South Arkansas, Brooke Berger currently works in El Dorado, Arkansas as editor of a weekly newspaper. She can be found whiling away the hours with her dog, Maggie. Next, Bill Scott plays his own childhood games, much to the chagrin of his mother, in Poison Sky.
North Little Rock, Arkansas, 1976. Some people winter in Florida, others in the south of France. I wintered behind Mother's blue 1972 Oldsmobile, a virtual tailpipe amusement park. In the summer, I'd run through the sprinkler in the front yard. In the winter, I'd dance in the magic smoke that shot out of the idling car's tailpipe. You had to get really close to the tailpipe because unlike regular smoke, magical smoke disappears quickly, but it smelled really good. I like to get a big whiff. "Stop that, it's poisonous," Mother would scream. She was always trying to spoil my fun. poisonous, I'd say. It's just smoke. I do this all the time. Do I look like I've been poisoned? There are two types of people. People who have fun and people who hate them for it. Jealous. Don't argue with me, she barked. Get in the car. The sun was setting and she was on a mission. We had to make it to Sears and back before Dad's had one too many scotch and waters. Mother needed him to unload the car when we returned home with our prize. Mother was fairly scrawny, only 5'3". Sure, her hair was ratted up to the point that it brushed the roof of the car, giving her the appearance of being 6 feet tall, but that wasn't going to help with any heavy lifting. There was a sweet spot between the first and second scotch where Dad was all smiles. Pliable. You could get him to do whatever. Once the third was poured, you couldn't get him out of the recliner. Unless it was to pour the fourth. We rolled out of the driveway. The sky was orange-red. Light refracted through stringy, tiger-striped clouds, giving them a purple hue. It was absolutely beautiful. Life was beautiful. I shared my joy with Mother. Look, Mama, look at the pretty sky. Why is it that color? Pollution. Smog, it's gonna kill us all. Unencumbered with data, facts, or any background in science whatsoever, there was nothing Mother couldn't explain. It was 1976, and the air was poisonous. It was only a matter of time before everyone in our neighborhood would wither and die. North Little Rock, Arkansas, population 40,000, and we were slowly dying. Those poor bastards in L.A. probably only had a few weeks left. At least we were likely to see 1977. That was one of the benefits in living in a place so intolerable that no one else would. You got to stick around and endure it, if only for another year. The Oldsmobile glided into the back loading dock of Sears. A burly man piled three boxes into the back and secured the trunk with twine. He banged on the car and sent us on our way. We'd gotten our first microwave. It had its own stand and came with a big white ceramic browning tray. What used to take 20 minutes in the oven now only took 40 seconds in the microwave. How we'd survive that long without it was anyone's guess. Mother said it cooked with radiation. Forks or metal of any kind were not to go in the microwave or else the food would become radioactive. Don't breathe the air and don't put metal in the microwave. Message received. The benefits of having your food ready in 40 seconds and not having to walk the two blocks to the store clearly outweighed the dangerous toxins the microwave and the Oldsmobile produced. Win-win. Time was precious. We were dying after all. We couldn't waste our time walking or waiting on food to cook. Walking. Ridiculous. Waiting. Even more ridiculous. Technology broadened my horizons, opening doors to culinary delicacies previously out of reach. So, I was melting down some Jolly Ranchers in the microwave and eating them with a fork. You had to be careful or you'd burn your tongue. But if you wait too long, then the candy gets hard again and you're right back where you started. A very narrow window of warm, soft deliciousness lies between tongue-scorching liquid and boring solid candy. I worked my way through the watermelon, grape, and green apple until all that was left was peach. Peach Jolly Ranchers. There was something not quite right about them. Even the color was off, pale peach. It may be an appropriate color for vinyl chairs in a retirement home sunroom in Central Florida, but for a candy treat? I was thinking pea-stained vinyl chairs, but that's just gross, and I'd already given too many descriptives, retirement home, sunroom, Central Florida. You get the point, peach Jolly Ranchers suck. But who knew that as a warm, gooey clump, they'd be heavenly? That's what makes cooking rewarding, the little surprises. It's worth the work. On the third and final peach rancher, I heard a popping from the microwave. That's new. Sparks shot from the fork I'd left on the plate. Oh, God, I left the fork in the microwave. We are all dead. I screamed for Mother. It was only fair to let her know. She should start planning on how she was going to spend her remaining days. Boy, was she mad, which I didn't get. She accepted the risk when she purchased the death box. The mountain of hair on her head shook and the vein in her forehead bulged when she was mad. I tried to tell her it was okay. We'd had a good life. But she was inconsolable. Before I could make things better with a hug, she thrust the contaminated plate into my hands. In its center, a peachy nuclear blob bubbled and hissed. The toxic fumes caused my eyes to water. I don't know what you're crying about, she said. It's my microwave you've ruined. Wait a minute. She's mad at me? Arms crossed, nostrils flared, she clearly expected me to eat the uranium-enriched Jolly Rancher. This was my punishment, my poison pill, and as such, I would be the first to go. It was better that way. At least I wouldn't have to watch my siblings lose their hair and slowly succumb to diarrhea and dehydration. I accepted my fate. The warm, peach-flavored death meal was in my mouth. I savored its radiation-infused goodness and waited for the hideous mutations to begin. I suppose it was too much to hope that the electromagnetic waves shooting through my head would give me some sort of superpower. If only I'd microwaved a spider instead of a Jolly Rancher. Then, as punishment, Mother would have coaxed the spider to bite me. I'd have been certain to get a superpower from a radioactive spider. But a peach Jolly Rancher? Unlikely. But who could really plan for these things? Not me, obviously. Sure, Peter Parker did, but I heard he lived in L.A., so he's probably already dead. 'Cause if the radiation doesn't get you, the smog will.
When Bill Scott's not working on his third novel, he's making the locals aware that pedestrians have the right-of-way, and crosswalks are not crosshairs. He expects his efforts on both to get him run over. In our final story of the night, Newton Jones finds someone to play with him, but he lives to regret the choice in High and Tight.
Okay, Newt. The garage wall can't take any more abuse, Mom said, as she tucked her hair under the baseball cap. You and I are going to play catch. Just don't throw to me like I am some kind of rookie who is scared of the ball. I'm going to throw hard to you, and I expect you to throw as hard as you can to me. I have played catch before. You won't hurt me. I agreed because she's my mom. You always do what your mom says. It's a law. Look it up. We started throwing to each other. Mom was really good. Her throws were hard and had almost no arc as they smacked into my official Nelson Fox fielder's glove. She had the same expression on her face for every throw. Teeth bared. Eyes open wide and blazing, and her entire arm and shoulder committed to the throw. A look of sheer determination that said she could give me all I could handle and then some. The only way to deal with such intimidating throwing was to respond in kind. It was time to Sandy Koufax her. During the summers of my youth, our backyard was transformed from a lush grassy expanse into a baseball field for the Jones boys and other neighborhood kids who aspired to grow up and play left field for the Chicago Cubs. There was no home plate, only the bare spot in front of the crabapple tree next to one of the flower beds. First base was usually an old, unused baseball glove, a frisbee, or the arm of a lawn chair. Second base was the cushion that belonged to the first base lawn chair. And third base was the water meter cover. Of course, the edge of the driveway was the left field line. There was no discernible right field line, but if a batted ball struck the first base chair, it was considered fair just to make life interesting. Left field was the always scenic asphalt surface of Ash Lane, and right field consisted of the McPherson's driveway. If you hit any car in the McPherson's driveway, you were automatically out. Home runs had to carry on the fly into the Creer's yard or into the McPherson's front yard. It was the greatest wiffle ball park in Major League wiffle ball history. Mom enjoyed having all this semi-pro sports activity in her backyard, but she hated the toll our running and sliding took on her yard, not to mention on our blue jeans. On occasion, she would sneak out to the field during our away games, rake up the soil on the bare spots, and put new grass seed out in a vain attempt to grass over first, second, third, and home. These efforts were doomed to fail for several reasons. First, it was the middle of the season with divisional playoffs nearby. The field would be heavily used, and grass seed had no chance under the repeated crushing of 30 pairs of PF flyers. Second, Mom's idea of protection for the newly seeded areas consisted of miniature fences, all of 6 inches high, made with little tiny pieces of wood with kite string tied to them. While Mom considered this to be a formidable barrier to the thundering wiffle ball herd, we, as semi-pro players, knew the only human being deterred by these structures was the mailman. The kite string fences would be gone in a cloud of dust with the first attempt to slide under a tag at second base. With the coming of the Little League years, it was time to get serious and put away childish things. It was time for hardball. It was time to prepare for my calling as the new left fielder for the Cubbies. When I woke up each morning, I wanted to play catch all day until it was too dark to see anything outside. I played catch with my dad until his bursitis kicked in and his arm and shoulder eventually gave out. This left me no alternative but to bounce the baseball off the brick wall of our garage for hours on end. After I had moved the garage several inches closer to the street with this activity, Mom stepped up to the challenge and strode bravely into the backyard to face the I-want-to-play-catch monster. That's when I accepted her challenge, held nothing back, and decided to bring the heat. I completed my windup. I brought my arm over the top, releasing one of my best throws, hoping it would curve, but knowing it wouldn't. At that same instant, the kitchen phone started ringing. Mom looked away for a moment, hoping someone would answer the phone. It was a moment that would live in baseball infamy. By this time, my throw was on its way at a velocity approaching the speed of light. It was headed towards Mom's head. Mom, look out! Mom looked back for the throw, but it was too late. The baseball caught her square in the nose. She dropped her glove, covered her face, and crumpled to her knees. I ran to check on her, apologized for my throw, and asked if she was okay. I could see red stuff on her fingers. Mom got up, ran into the kitchen, and stood over the sink, blood running everywhere. Dad heard the commotion and came to Mom's aid at the sink. I think your nose is broken.
Why do you think so?
Because it looks like an S. Dad rushed Mom to the hospital. My brothers and I were left in the care of the McPhersons, who were told that I had attempted to kill my mother. At any moment, the police would arrive and draw a chalk outline of my mom's body on the spot where I had beamed her. I would have to leave home and fend for myself. I knew any employment application would sniff out my shameful act. Criminal history. Please indicate whether you have ever committed a crime, especially if it involved physical harm or death to your mother. After what seemed like an eternity, but was really only 3 hours, Dad brought Mom home, By some miracle of modern medicine, she would survive the injuries. Her face was heavily bandaged and braced with this large triangular contraption that straightened the S out of her nose. I was grateful and relieved she would be okay and would continue to raise my brothers after I ran away from home. Mom gave me a hug and told me she loved me. She hugged me and loved me for the rest of her life. We played catch frequently after that incident, and I went on to a stellar little league career, although I was not destined to become the new left fielder for the Cubs. There was one thing I never told Mom about that fateful day. I thought it was best she not know. The official scorer gave her an error.
Newton Jones is an attorney living in Dallas, Texas. He and Vivian, his much better half, are parents to Andrew and Sam, who have, thus far, inflicted no personal injuries upon their parents. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazines, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
All right, here's a song I wrote a few years ago. This is it's a drinking song, so if you got a drink, it's good. You'll enjoy it much better. Well, I used to think women were better. You can't make them stay out of those sleazy motels. You can dress them in diamonds and roses, but I don't think you quite understand. You can get on your knees and you can beg them, please, or you can shut up and drink like a man. I went home to see my woman. Could not believe what I found. She spoke in my favorite brand with an insurance salesman. The deal had already gone and drink like a man. Well, life is a bottle of whiskey. You're only as drunk as you feel. I thought when she's gone that she'd miss me, but she don't. And that's the deal. Well, I used to think women were top on my list, but I've known you women too long. You give them all of your best, just shut up and drink like a man. You can curse the whole world, you can cry like a girl, or you can shut up and drink like a man.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.